From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with writer James Wolcott. He writes the mixed media column for Vanity Fair, reviewing all aspects of popular culture, including books, TV, movies, music, and anything interesting that crosses his path. Also today, I talk with Richard Hell, the former punk rocker gave up music and is now writing poetry and editing a new journal. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Rainbow, the new album by Dolly Parton, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Broadcast News, a behind-the-scenes romantic comedy about the split-second world of TV journalism. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Writer and critic James Wolcott left college before completing his degree to come to New York. Armed with a recommendation from Norman Mailer, he landed a job at the Village Voice. Like the old story goes, he started in the circulation department. But after a couple of years, the editors unleashed him to write. Since then, he's turned his incisive thoughts and cutting wit on all manifestations of popular culture. He's written about TV for the Village Voice and New York Magazine, reviewed books for Esquire, covered cultural topics for Harper's, and movies for Texas Monthly. For the past 4 years, he's written a popular culture column called Mixed Media at Vanity Fair magazine. I spoke with James Wolcott from station WNYC in New York City. I asked him to describe his approach to writing about popular culture.
Well, I've been doing it for so long that I sort of don't even think about the methodology. I just see myself as sort of a giant antenna, sort of taking it all in. And sometimes you're taking too much in, and you have to, you know, back off for a while. I mean, there are times when I've sat at my desk and realized I had the television on, the radio on, and I was reading a magazine at the same time. And not only was I doing it, but I was actually, you know, filtering through all the information. I mean, I was actually able to follow the three things simultaneously.
John Cage once told me that he thought that meditation form for the modern world was being able to do three or four things at the same time. it's the modern equivalent of sitting zazen.
Well, I believe it. I once was at the Talking Heads loft years and years ago when the Talking Heads were still a trio. They lived on Christie Street, and at one point we were watching TV. They were playing one of their tapes. There were about four or five things going on, and yet there was no sense of dissonance. I mean, there was no sense of confusion. And I realized that, you know, that is for a lot of people, baby boom people who grew up in front of the TV, we are able to sort of switch back and forth in different modes. I'm not sure it's terribly healthy, but we're able to do it.
No, I first started reading you when you were writing about television for the Village Voice. And one of the things that really struck me about your writing was that whereas most television reviewers and critics write about the business and ratings wars and they follow the new shows, you were lying awake in the middle of the night watching Mary Tyler Moore reruns and writing about it, or Australian import late-night TV talk shows and writing about it.
Oh, sure.
Why were you taking that approach to television?
Well, because I think that's the way most people watch television in real life. You know, a lot of the critics for daily TV papers, daily papers particularly, what they do is they sit in their offices and they get cassettes delivered to them. And they plunk in the cassette and they sit and they watch it and they make phone calls while it's, you know, while they're watching the tape, because most of the time you don't need to concentrate on it, and this is sort of how they do it. It's almost like sort of a leisurely, gentlemanly occupation. Whereas because I was running for a weekly, I could sort of do it the way people who gorge on TV do it, which is you do end up watching fluky stuff. I was talking to another TV critic the other day. We were both comparing notes on the movie Wall Street, and we were noting how, you know, the head of the manager of the firm that Charlie Sheen is employed by is played by the guy who does the Pathmark commercials. They were saying, oh, well, there's the Pathmark guy. And the poor schlub who gets fired in his bow tie and his carnation is, in fact, George Jefferson's friend. And you pick up a lot. I mean, I was talking to a friend the other night. We were doing 15 minutes of jokes about Love American Style and the sort of people who appeared only on Love American Style. This is not the kind of thing that most of the TV critics deal with. I mean, John J. O'Connor, I don't think, you know, thinks about Love American Style very much.
Well, as you point out, you also in Vanity Fair now write about new shows. You recently wrote about the Fox Network, and you described it as fancying itself as a new breed of animal, but that it also makes a play for the secret slob in all of us. Can I ask you to describe what you mean by that?
Well, the secret slob is best personified by the character in the Fox show called Married with Children, a character named Al Bundy who sells shoes. And when he gets home, he plops on the sofa in his white T-shirt. He plunges his hands down his pants. He drinks beer. He talks, makes cracks about how he doesn't want to make love to his wife. And you get the feeling that this is the kind of hairy animal that, the Fox Network is trying to appeal to. It's an attempt to go sort of downscale characters and yet at the same time trying to reach an upscale audience, because I think one thing that people have found is that upscale audiences like downscale characters. I mean, yuppies are among the biggest fans of the Honeymooners, for example. And I think that's where Fox is making its pitch. Its shows are much more vulgar than even the shows you get on the networks.
Well, you know, in watching Married with Children, I can't understand the woman character in that, the woman who plays the wife of the shoe salesman who you just described, because she's the kind of woman who's home all day, just like eating and watching TV and having coffee clutches with friends. And it's such a stereotype that I don't even think exists anymore.
No, because for one thing, that kind of family, you'd have to have two incomes. And you wouldn't be able to support a woman just sitting around. I mean, that's sort of a 1950s stereotype, that the woman sits around eating chocolates, watching her soap operas, and basically has her hand glued to a remote control. Although I would say that there are also a lot of vibrator jokes, so you don't know where the other hand is glued. I've counted about 3 or 4 vibrator jokes just in the few episodes I've seen of the show.
Well, you said that you said. I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Definitely a stereotype, but I think what they're trying to do is they're saying, yeah, these are stereotypes, but we're playing with them. And we're countering upscale stereotypes like the Cosby family. I mean, they often, the people connected with Married with Children often say, we're not doing the Cosby show.
You said that it's mostly yuppies who identify with honeymooners type shows about the working class, and if that's true, I wonder why you think it's true.
I think it's because it represents a slightly uncivilized part of themselves that they like to be in touch with. It sort of corresponds roughly with what George Orwell wrote about when he wrote about how there's certain English stereotypes that go on and on forever, no matter how cultured the society becomes. And he was referring to mother-in-law jokes and dirty postcards. And, you know, there's some part of us that doesn't want to give the knight the Michelob and you know, wear yellow ties and have those, you know, designer lenses. And I think that these shows sort of touch that kind of more grubby spirit.
One of your favorite shows on television is Pee-wee's Playhouse, and about that you've written that it makes everything else on TV look like noise and filler. You described Pee-wee as a kiddie show cut up with art consciousness. He has a strange sense of goodness tucked away amid all his tics. What do you think of the new season of Pee-wee's Playhouse?
I've only seen a couple of them because, frankly, I keep forgetting to set my VCR. I tried to tape it 1 week, and I ended up with Mighty Mouse, which...
That's a pretty good show.
Yeah, well, actually, Mighty Mouse, it's done by Ralph Bakshi, who's done a lot of interesting animation. But the couple of shows I saw, Pee-wee's, I thought the show didn't seem quite right, and I'm not sure why. I'm not sure if it's because they made changes in the setup or they're repeating too much of this stuff, but it doesn't quite cohere the way it did last year. And I'm not sure why that is, but it almost seems like a faded version of itself.
Do you worry?
Maybe that it's hard for Pee-wee to keep up that manic energy week after week.
Well, do you worry about Pee-wee getting overexposed? I started getting concerned about this when I saw him singing with Dolly Parton on her new variety show. It didn't feel right at all.
Well, I do think singing with Dolly Parton is, you know, you're riding the trap door to obscurity. I mean, I think at this point no one should sing duets with Dolly Parton, which is not a knock on Dolly Parton, but there's something about that show. No, I know what you mean. It's one of the great problems, and you know, which is how do you not get overexposed, and why is it that some people can be overexposed and still resilient, and then others you know, sort of, you know, are instantly farmed out or instantly, you know, outmoded. I mean, for example, I saw a commercial the other night for Dynasty perfume, and it was Crystal writing a letter to Blake and Blake writing a letter back to Crystal about their wonderful perfume. And I thought, geez, these guys are still on? You know, I couldn't believe it, you know, that we're supposed to still care about Blake and Crystal.
Well, did you ever have a taste for those shows, Dallas and Dynasty?
I sort of like Dallas the first few years it was on. In fact, it's funny, I think I wrote one of the very first reviews of Dallas when it was more or less a summer replacement series, and it was a very strange show back then because that's when you had, you know, No Neck Lucy up in the hayloft there with Ray Krebs, who we later found out was actually a Ewing's son, which really makes what they were doing pretty kinky. And the show was different than, I sort of liked the big scale of Dallas, and I've always found Larry Hagman an amusing actor. I've always thought he was an underrated actor. I think the show's completely burnt itself out, and I mean, the only amusing thing about Dallas now is how many bubble baths, you know, the characters take. I mean, I've never seen so many characters do, you know, business in the bubble bath, you know, while they've got this, you know, the cellular phone. Dynasty, I was never that big a fan of, except when the early years when Pamela Sue Martin was on it, because she gave it a certain neurotic craziness that I think has since been lost. I think all those shows just simply got too caught up in their costumes and their motifs. I mean, how many times can you watch Joan Collins swank into the room and, "I'll destroy you, Blake Carrington"? You know, I mean, they're always threatening to destroy each other. The others I was never into. I never got into Knot's Landing or Falcon Crest.
James Wolcott is my guest, and he writes about popular culture for Vanity Fair. Has this phenomenon ever happened to you where you're watching TV and suddenly your eyes well up with tears and you get terribly sad? Maybe you're watching a game show or a Reach Out and Touch Someone commercial, something that you really shouldn't be emotionally, not only emotionally involved with, but weeping at. Has that ever happened to you? You'll think I'm crazy, I know this.
No, Terry, it hasn't. Have you talked to anybody about this?
Well, actually, I've mentioned this to a couple of people who had it happen too. It's a strange thing. I don't know. It happened to me watching a game show, seeing all that forced merriment. I nearly broke down and cried. I don't know.
No, that's never happened to me. I know people who make rituals of watching certain shows because they know those shows will make them cry. You know, the people who watch It's a Wonderful Life every year.
Oh, that's different, yeah.
But no, I've never had that happen.
Okay. You recently wrote an article on a new all-sports radio station that just came into being in New York, and you found yourself listening to it almost in spite of yourself, and you wrote that this all-sports station is just one more sign of how reluctant we are to be alone with our thoughts, how wired we are to distraction.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that way yourself, that when you're tuning in sometimes to radio and TV, that it's this sign of a reluctance to be alone with your thoughts?
Oh, I think that's definitely true. I was listening to WFAN last night, and they were talking about the Golden State Warriors. I don't follow basketball. I had no idea what they were talking about, but I had it on. I think the whole society, I think our whole culture is built on distraction at this point. I think we're really terrified of having a moment in which we're not fed in from the outside. I mean, they're, you know, the media has become sort of our intravenous tubes. And I think I'm as guilty of that as anybody. Although I'm probably more guilty than most, because I do sort of take in a lot more media, and I can sort of say, well, I'm doing it for my column. But in fact, I'd probably be doing it anyway.
Well, you seem to thrive on that kind of input.
Yeah, you see, I don't have any other bad habits, so maybe this is the only, you know, the only addiction I have. I mean, maybe if you have other bad habits, you don't need to take in as much media. But I also find myself sloughing a lot more of it off these days. I find that I don't listen to very much pop music. I'm actually watching less television. I don't know if it's because my response to what's being broadcast has changed, or if it's simply a matter of overload and you get older and you don't want to take all that in.
My guest is James Wolcott, and he writes about popular culture for Vanity Fair in a column called Mixed Media. He's also written for The Village Voice, Esquire, Harper's, New York Magazine, Texas Monthly, and the New York Review of Books. We'll talk some more about popular culture after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air. Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer James Wolcott is my guest. Let's talk about literature a little bit. You recently had a column called The Young and the Wasted, which was basically a review of new books by Tama Janowitz and Bret Easton Ellis, two of the younger novelists who've been getting a lot of attention lately. What are some of the traits that you think characterize this group of younger writers?
Well, a very sort of studied... I don't want to call it irony. It's sort of semi-irony, a sense that, a sort of drifting sense that anything goes, a media shrewdness, which means that they pepper their books with references to things in pop culture. But also, I think, and I sort of wish I'd gotten at this more in the piece I wrote, a very kind of almost white supremacist sense of exclusivity. Let me be specific. In the Tama Janowitz book, for example, her most recent book, which is about a black cannibal coming to Manhattan, that book really is sort of borderline racist in its stereotypes. The Bret Easton Ellis book, which I did mention in the column, has a very, very long anecdote in it in which a guy discomforts other people at a dinner table by telling them, you know, a racist joke, and I mean a very ugly racist joke. There is a sense in both of their books and in a lot of the books of the younger writers that if you're not white and on the make, you're really out there in the fringes. You're really out there in the jungle. But I think this is all caught up with them. The response, not just my response, but the response of most critics to their new books has not been good. And Tama Janowitz, for one, is beginning to look a little punch drunk.
You compared these new young writers with Jack Kerouac, and you said that Kerouac's Dharma bums were searching, alive, responsive, and that Kerouac had an affinity for pilgrims, losers, and the left behind. You think that the younger writers don't have an affinity for losers?
Oh, no. I think that the left behind ought to be left behind.
Mm-hmm.
No, Kerouac and those people, they had their excesses, and I have problems with some of their writing, but they were interested in other things, you know, and when they would hear about, you know, some kind of Eastern religion and how it might affect them and, you know, and somehow some way to incorporate Buddhism and Zen, you know, they were interested. They were taking it in. I get the feeling with these writers that they're just on a very narrow party circuit and that really nothing beyond that circuit much interests them. I've seen Bret Ellis on TV, and he's the very opposite of somebody who's sort of manic and searching. He's sort of slumped in the chair and talking in a very soft, bored voice. And I can't tell with these people how much of it is pose and how much of it is real. The problem is, if you do a pose long enough, you become the pose. And, I mean, that's already happened with Tama Janowitz. At this point, she's all pose and no writer.
Do you ever have to ask yourself if any of your... criticism of their work is generational because you're not a part of that generation?
No, and in fact, I'm probably not that far in age from Tama Janowitz.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's been around a while. You know, she was writing in the late 70s. I don't feel any particular jealousy or envy. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, some part of me is annoyed when, you know, writers who are that young are making that much money and getting the movie deals. But, you know, you try to block that out. I mean, I don't experience that sense of annoyance. I mean, there are other younger writers that I feel perfectly comfortable with. I think it's probably more the publicity that they've gotten rather than any kind of generational thing. Although the generational thing can work in other ways. I recently wrote about Arthur Miller's memoirs, which I found very overblown and windy and badly written. And I got a letter from another writer who agreed with some of my points, but said that he found a lot of it quite moving. And I realized that in that case, it was a generational thing because this writer had grown up in the same era as Arthur Miller, and he had experienced a lot of the same things. And so there were things in Arthur Miller's work that just didn't touch me at all because I hadn't lived through it. I think sometimes the generational thing works further when you're dealing with older writers than with younger writers. Because, in fact, I mean, I listen to the same records Brett Ellis listens to, and I've been to the same clubs, so there's not really that much distance. Where there is a distance between me and Arthur Miller, because I was never, you know, held by Marxism and hence felt disillusioned later.
There's been a series of books lately saying that we're no longer culturally literate, that there are no young intellectuals to replace the older breed of intellectuals. Do you buy any of that?
Well, I think there's a certain truth to it, but the argument is usually slanted because the people complaining about it are usually leftist intellectuals who are basically complaining that there are no leftist intellectuals, because to them, leftist intellectuals are the only intellectuals. So what they're complaining about usually is that there isn't a partisan review group now that there was back then. I think the one thing that is very demoralizing and depressing is the way that structuralism and deconstruction has occupied campuses. And even though students don't seem terribly interested in it, you now have whole departments dominated by these people, and these people are not interested at all in reaching the public or dealing in any kind of commonsensical discourse, and hence they end up talking only to themselves and trying to outdo themselves. I think that is a genuine problem, and I think probably English studies will be wrecked in years to come by their influence. And also, there's a lot, you know, other people have pointed this out. There's a lot more Marxism on campus and in faculty departments than there is in the rest of America. I mean, Marxism doesn't hold anything in the rest of America, yet on many college campuses, you do find your Marxist intellectuals in the history department, English department. So I think there's a certain sense that, you know, there certainly isn't the cluster of intellectuals that you had in a partisan review group, but they're out there.
You've written that academics distrust lively writing. What led you to that conclusion?
Well, mostly reading the books by academics. because the thing about an academic is you don't want to stick your head out too far, because it allies you with a position that you may not want to be allied to in the long run. So, for example, I mean, even though he was a very good critic, Lionel Trilling sort of represents this, because his writing was full of exquisite qualifications, exquisite modulations, and all sorts of backtracking within the same sentence. And you felt that he didn't want to stand in too exposed a position. I think that's very much an academic trait. I also think it derives a little bit from the clerical pose of T.S. Eliot, who was often, you know, just being very exquisite in his qualifications. One of the good things about being a journalistic writer is you don't have to do that. In fact, your editors would scream to the skies if you did it.
Well, speaking of good writing and bad writing, you have a column called The Scroll of Shame, in which you single out some of the worst writing that you were able to find that month. How did you start going hunting for really bad writing? And the kinds of things you look for, why don't you explain the kinds of things you look for?
Well, to be fair, the column, in a sense, was modeled after a column in the English magazine Private Eye called, they have a column called Sood's Corner. And I sort of did the same format. The difference was that I would put little subheadings on the items. I I love bad writing. There's something that cheers me up about bad writing. You know, particularly writing that's not inept, but writing that's very pretentious.
Or overwritten.
Overwritten, windy, a kind of clashing metaphor that doesn't work. And the great thing about that sort of writing is that you don't have to look for it. It looks for you. I mean, you can just sort of page through it, and it just jumps off the page. And there's some writers that you can depend on to do it. And it's gotten to the point now where if I were doing a new Scroll of Shame, I wouldn't use those writers because it's too easy.
Well, I'm going to, just to give a sense of the kind of thing you look for, I'll read without mentioning who wrote it. a book blurb that was written, and you quote the blurb, and it goes, "What he does with words, reading Madison Smart Bell is like watching a juggler do it with 200 apples, 500 oranges, and a couple of newborn kittens. And with the other hand, he is a magician. Before your eyes, images appear like doves and purple kerchiefs, but watch out. Between your screams of delight are his overtures with death, croaky, black, and rupee." That's pretty hyperbolic.
Yeah. Well, I read a book blurb the other day that, and I'll tell you who did write it. It was Roy Blunt, and the blurb went, "Reading Barry Yorgrow is addictive, like putting peanuts up your nose and they turn into spaceships or something." And I thought, first of all, Roy, what have you been doing? But the thing I couldn't believe was the publisher actually used that as a blurb. If I were Barry Yorgrow, I don't think I'd like my writing compared to putting peanuts up your nose.
I hope you don't like going to literary parties, because I imagine you don't get a lot of invitations after you single out fellow writers for embarrassment the way you do.
Well, I go to a few. I don't go to that many. The funny thing that happens is when you're introduced to a writer and the first few moments you're introduced, a writer, you know, a person's courteous instincts take hold. You know, they're shaking your hand, they're going, "Hi, how are you?" And then you realize they're beginning to register who you are, you know, and then a certain amount of disdain travels, you know, down their arm and into your hand. So that happens occasionally. I've walked into parties where there have been three or four people that I've reviewed, but most people don't want to cause scenes or come up and confront you. It's only after they've had a couple drinks that they might do that.
Have you ever written something that, in looking back, you think really belongs on the Scroll of Shame, even though you wrote it yourself?
I think probably if I went back and looked at things. See, one thing is that I don't tend to look back when I write something. I even have a hard time looking at my galleys. Once I've written it, I've sort of torn it out of my head. And I'm sure that if I went back and looked at things that I wrote 5-6 years ago, I would probably find things that would make me cringe. I would hope that they wouldn't be overwritten in quite the same way, because one of the things that would get something into the Scroll of Shame would be something in which the writer takes himself very seriously, that a kind of stiff-backed posture when they're writing. And I would hope that none of my writing would have that, but I'm sure that I would find metaphors that would just make me cringe.
Well, we only have a few seconds left, but can you tell me, like, really briefly how you became a critic?
I think I fell out of the bassinet. No, I don't know. I was this annoying when I was very young. I mean, I can remember going to movies when I was 8 years old, and it would be a dumb spy movie, and I'd say, you know, that really wasn't well worked out. And they go, "God, Wonka, we don't care," you know, because you know they were just kids. They were 8 year olds, and so there's something ingrained. I don't know genetically or how, but I've been this bothersome since I could walk and talk.
Do you go to movies and friends say to you, "Oh, come on, Jim, lighten up. Why don't you just relax and enjoy it?"
Well, some people do that. No, actually, I'm usually enjoying myself anyway. But you know what people usually do is they usually say, "Well, I don't know, I kind of liked it." You know, like you can marshal all of your arguments against a movie and you can be incredibly specific. But people just go, "Oh, I don't know, I kind of liked it." It's because a lot of people take movies or books or whatever in a very kind of cloudy, generalized way. Whereas I am sort of looking at how it's put together and why the director or the writer did certain things. Most people don't care about that.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been writer James Wolcott. He's a regular columnist on popular culture for Vanity Fair magazine. His column's called Mixed Media. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Mary King. She's written a memoir about her experiences as the communications coordinator for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during the height of the Civil Rights Movement. Her memoir is titled Freedom Song. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with Richard Hell. He was one of New York's first punk rockers and co-starred in the movie Smithereens, but he ended his music career and kind of dropped out of sight. Now he's re-emerged as a poet and editor. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker gives a serious listen to the new Dolly Parton album, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Broadcast News, starring William Hurt as a TV anchorman who doesn't know what he's talking about. It's the latest film from James Brooks, who directed Terms of Endearment. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. President Reagan and Senate Republican leader Robert Dole gave each other some much-needed support today. The two appeared at the White House, where Dole endorsed the recently signed intermediate-range nuclear missile treaty with the Soviet Union.
I'm here to keep my promise to the president. He wanted my support. He has my support. And I'm going to be very active, as I have in the past, to try to get the treaty ratified.
Dole's appearance with the president today was seen as a boost to his presidential campaign. Dole is one of six Republican hopefuls. Another is Vice President George Bush, whose supporters were miffed at the president's appearance with a rival candidate. Dole denied there was anything political about his announcement. President Reagan today repeated his pledge to remain neutral during the primaries. Vice President George Bush joined the president in supporting the arms sales to Iran in an effort to win the release of the American hostages in Lebanon. That's according to a newly discovered White House memo released today by the Senate Iran-Contra Committee. The committee said the memo was the first evidence that the committee found concerning the vice president's involvement in the Iran-Contra affair. Beginning on Monday, airport and airline workers will be required to go through metal detector security checks. The new rule was announced today by the Department of Transportation. The rule change followed the December 7th crash of a Pacific Southwest Airlines flight in California, which investigators believe was caused by the shooting spree of a fired U.S. Air employee. All 43 people on board were killed. General Accounting Office official Kenneth Mead told a House subcommittee of widespread security problems at major airports, including lax control over employee security badges.
At another Category X airport, airport officials stated that approximately 16% of about 38,000 badges, or over 6,000, could not be accounted for. At this same airport, we visited three other service companies who were not tracking the retrieval of badges from employees they had terminated.
Mead did not name the airport in question, but a congressional source identified it as Los Angeles International. Ruling party candidate No Tae-woo declared himself the victor today in South Korea's first direct presidential elections in 16 years. No vowed to reconcile with opposition forces, but losing opposition candidate Kim Young-sam accused the government of rigging the election and called on South Koreans to rebel. In Gwangju and five other cities, thousands of opposition supporters took to the streets, throwing rocks and firebombs at police. A five-day hearing into the competence of convicted serial killer Ted Bundy ended today in Orlando, Florida. U.S. District Judge J. Kendall Sharp ruled that Bundy had been competent to stand trial for murder of a Lake City, Florida schoolgirl. NPR's Joe Maglino reports.
Ted Bundy calmly gathered up his legal files and flashed a grin at reporters after Judge Sharp called him a diabolical genius and the most competent serial killer in the nation. The hearing into Bundy's competency was ordered by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which stayed his scheduled execution in November of 1986. Bundy was sentenced to death for the murders of 12-year-old Kimberly Leach and two Florida State University sorority sisters. After ruling Bundy competent at the time of his 1980 trial for the Leach murder, Judge Sharp launched into an indictment of the death penalty appeal process. He said the deterrent effect of the death penalty is lost in the long delays available to convicted murderers. Bundy has been on Florida's death row since 1979. This is Joe Maglino reporting.
Independent counsel Whitney North Seymour said today the conviction yesterday of former presidential aide Michael Deaver was only a thumb in the dike against the growing wave of influence peddling in Washington. Deaver was found guilty on three charges of lying to Congress and a grand jury about his use of White House contacts to promote his lobbying business. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album from a star first associated with country music. Things have changed for Dolly Parton.
Dolly Parton is one of those pop stars whose pervasive familiarity has bred a certain amount of contempt. I think it would be hard to find many people who claim a serious interest in popular music who also admire Dolly Parton. Over the years, she's turned herself into a cartoonish exaggeration of a pop sex symbol. I like to think that I'm an exception to this rule, even if Parton's worst excesses try my patience. To hear her new album, Rainbow, you'd never know that Parton was, almost 20 years ago, an excellent country music songwriter. She composed meticulous story songs about her hard life on a farm in Locust Ridge, Tennessee, and sang them in a sweet soprano. These days, that voice is still the same, but it's being used to deliver songs written, most of the time, by others. And the music is pop, not country, such as Parton's new interpretation of Smokey Robinson's Two Lovers.
Well, I've got two.
I think that song suggests what's good and bad about Dolly Parton's new album. Her singing is just fine. It's a vocal performance that does a good job of conveying the romantic ambivalence that Smokey Robinson was suggesting in his lyric. But the music and production by Steve Goldstein is at once slick and vague, with mushy percussion and wispy synthesizers that do little to support Parton. In this sense, Rainbow is typical of the kind of albums country music stars record when they want to go pop, or in industry slang, cross over. Rather than offend her country music fans by committing some raucous rock and roll, Parton finds gentle pop songs that are characterized chiefly by their harmlessness. It's also highly significant, I think, that when Parton does write a song these days, her only subject matter is her own stardom. That's the entire subject of Could I Have Your Autograph? If Dolly Parton weren't such a disarming performer, it would be nothing less than an insult for her to have written that song, a treacly speculation on what her fans are thinking when they approach her for an autograph. It's not as if Parton has lost touch with her talent. Last year, the album she recorded with Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris, called Trio, contained some of Parton's best, most pure country singing. And it's not as if there's anything wrong with being impure about pop music. The best song on Rainbow is a fine, catchy tune indeed, called The River Unbroken.
Waiting for the train to come, I keep waiting for the train to come. Dreaming of the river and the rising sun, I keep thinking about the world to come. My heart.
could say that Dolly Parton is a victim of her own success, having achieved prominence as a recording artist, a movie actress, a pin-up queen, and the star of her own TV variety show, she's become a facile celebrity. These days, people are more apt to remark on how much weight she's lost rather than how well she sings. At the same time, she creates just enough good work to let us all know that there's still an artist laboring beneath all that glitter.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're listening to Fresh Air. In the mid-70s, Richard Hell was an originator of the New York punk music scene. With Tom Verlaine, he co-founded the band Television. He later sang and wrote songs for his own band, Richard Hell and the Voidoids. He also co-starred in Susan Seidelman's film, Smithereens, which is about a young woman who desperately wants to break into the punk scene. Hell first came to New York with the ambition of living the poet's life. He ran away from his home in Kentucky when he was 16. Some of his early poems were published in the New Directions Annual Review. Hell retired from music in 1984 and returned to writing poetry. Now he's programming the regular poetry readings at the St. Mark's Poetry Project in New York, and he's put together a literary review called Cuz, due out soon. When Richard Hell abandoned music, he left behind a song that many considered a punk anthem, Blank Generation.
I always really loved music, you know, and I had regular kids' fantasies of that's the perfect life, where you write your own ticket and you're given license to be depraved and follow your every whim, you know. And I was getting real frustrated with what was going on in my life as a writer. I felt like I was doing this exquisite work, and nobody cared, you know, nobody even noticed, nobody reads. And so I decided I would, you know, I'd be able to do all the same things in rock and roll that I could do as a writer. I mean, after all, words are used. And, you know, be able to get some response, you know, be able to be heard.
When you started performing, you were really in some of the first bands in what came to be known as New York New Wave or punk music. Did you see yourself as being the kind of beginnings of something new in rock music? Did you think at the time that this was the beginning of something?
Oh, absolutely. I knew it was. You know, the first band I was in, me and Tom started, was Television. And that was in 1974. And we wanted to reinvent rock and roll, return it to where it really came from. At that time, it was, you know, the music you heard was this, you heard stadium heavy metal and the really unbearable saccharine goo of groups like Yes and you know, I can't even remember. It was a horrible period there in the early 70s. We wanted to do urban slum music, you know. I kind of thought of myself as a modern folk musician because, you know, we were we were from the barnyard slums of the decaying cities, you know. And I conceived of the band as conveying our message in every from every angle, you know, the way we looked, the way we gave interviews, and all of it was all of it had to be seamless.
Well, one of the things that you started doing was
I cut my hair real short and ragged, and I wore the torn up clothes that were all I could afford, and all, you know. And
but that ended up becoming a style. Did that really make you laugh and seem very absurd? When torn clothes
kind of,
became
I just
a big
kind
fashion
of,
statement.
Well, I kind of learned something from it. You know, that's all.
What'd you learn?
Well, just that everything gets. First of all, everything gets appropriated by the media. You know, because within a few years, I saw in the windows of Macy's torn T-shirts with safety pins through them. You know, and second of all. That is kind of futile. It's worth doing, but it's actually kind of futile to try to lead people not to have leaders, because you know it's kind of puts them in an impossible position, because they want to show that's their attitude too, and to do that. The only thing they can dream up is to do what you're doing.
You came to rock performance with a lot of energy and kind of commitment, but without a kind of real singer's voice. After you perform for a while, do you run the risk of either getting really polished or getting really frustrated with not being, a technical musician?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I wish I could sing, you know. I really wish I could sing.
I should say here, I really like your singing a lot.
Well, thanks, but you're right. It did get frustrating after a while. In fact, you know, now and then I would try to do some real singer's song, and that, you know, and I never could, because I just don't have an ear. But I think I did all right for myself.
What did you eventually get out of music and return to poetry?
I've always thought of myself as a writer, you know. I never changed. I just never made any effort to publish anything once I started doing rock and roll. You know, now and then I'd get an offer and I'd go along with it, but I never, you know, pursued it. And I always thought of looking into acting, because there's something exciting about acting, too. Acting is a kind of spiritual path of its own. But then I realized I'm not cut out for that either. I tried taking a class in acting, and I ended up almost getting arrested for assault.
Why?
Well, we were doing this exercise in class where one person is supposed to kind of annoy the other person. And the teacher I had was kind of this, his teaching method was this sort of boot camp style, you know. He tried to tear everybody down in order to rebuild them, you know, the way they do in the Marines. Like, and I really don't respond very well to that kind of treatment. But I was doing my best, because I thought, you know, I'll give this guy the benefit of the doubt, you know, because I want to learn. And he set up this exercise where literally one person is supposed to keep preventing the other person from finishing what they're doing. He decided to use me for an example, and he came up himself to play the part of the person who was trying to annoy me. And he made this gesture which just snapped me, and I threw him against the wall and ripped his shirt off. And the guy's really bigger than me. He could have torn me apart. And he yelled at me for about a half an hour. But he let me stay in class.
I guess poetry's a lot safer than acting is for you.
It made me realize that in acting, you have to be willing to show everything about yourself. You know, you have to really just strip yourself down to where you're a walking nerve. And you don't hesitate to exhibit your most shameful impulses. And I can't do that. I can do it on a page in my room, and I like to. But not in public with people looking at me.
Do you think that the poems you're writing now are influenced by the rock music that you've written and sung?
Not at all. It's the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was writing long before I ever started doing rock music.
What about the way you read poems now? Is the way you read poems influenced at all by the way you used to perform when you sang?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, they're entirely different. Okay. You haven't heard me read, right?
No, but I'm about to.
Yeah.
Okay, read Biting the Thought.
biting the thought, sucking it back like spaghetti, entrails, infinitesimal verbal lies. The thought, the lines, followed backwards and backwards to the doorway of a tiny cottage. God's in the forest cutting wood, but the table in the immaculate room is set. Upon the shining plate there lies a little morsel of conception. But I've lost my appetite. Devoid of appetite, I don't have any appetite anymore. God comes back. Not hungry, eh? No, sir. That gets a big laugh. People start clapping and standing up, giving me a hand. I'm very grateful. They're wonderful, though I don't understand it. I'm clapping too, and we start kissing. The kissing gets serious.
Richard Hell reading his poem, Biting the Thought. On January 7th, he'll read with Jim Carroll and Richard Price at The Bottom Line in New York.
Your mind's a wreck, but that's fine. It corresponds to mine. We're in a room, the door closes on.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story is he following?
We're following the announcement by Senator Dole, Robert Dole of Kansas, that he endorses the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. Remember, Vice President Bush was seen as getting a lot of publicity and a lot of help in his bid for the Republican presidential nomination from his involvement in the summit. Well, now Senator Dole has had an announcement with the president to say that he, too, supports that treaty. Also, the aftermath of the South Korean presidential election and the aftermath of the verdict in the Michael Deaver trial. The special prosecutor says that beyond Mr. Deaver's conviction on a couple of counts of lying, there also is much, much more corruption in Washington.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of the new James Brooks movie, Broadcast News. Brooks has been a creative force in television for years and directed the Academy Award-winning Terms of Endearment.
I feel a little queasy about liking this movie as much as I do. Broadcast News is so ingratiating and winsome, so full of little come-ons and winks and nudges, you can feel it coddling you, and at times you may find yourself resisting. Don't bother. This movie is irresistible. It pretends to be a satire of TV journalism, but at heart, it's a brilliantly polished sitcom for the screen, a sitcom that transcends itself by praising rather than insulting the audience's intelligence. The writer-director, James Brooks, was the man behind The Mary Tyler Moore Show, and as good as that show was, it was television, and it pandered. And Broadcast News feels like the tour de force about broadcast journalism that must have been building up inside Brooks all along. The insider's talk in it is sharp and snappy and bracing, and the movie's best scenes are high-tension set pieces in which we see how TV news is put together, how the deadlines and the look, ma, no net atmosphere of live broadcasting scare you and thrill you at the same time. There are three main characters: the handsome but dim anchorman played by William Hurt, the brilliant but uncharismatic reporter played by Albert Brooks, and the spiky, hyper-efficient producer they both adore. She's played by Holly Hunter. Like any good TV show, the movie's best moments are built on the way these three rub and tickle and gnaw at each other. And the actors are all so good that every conversation is multidimensional. You see what the speaker is saying, what he thinks he's saying, and what the person he's talking to is hearing all at once. Take, for instance, this little exchange between William Hurt and Holly Hunter, which appears to be an argument about professionalism and is really about whether they're going to sleep together.
So, you're not well-educated, you have almost no experience, and you can't write.
Yeah, and I'm making a fortune.
It's hard for me to advise you since you personify something that I truly think is dangerous.
Uh-huh.
I agree with you. You're not qualified, so get qualified. You can insist on being better prepared. You don't have to just leave it with, I don't write, I'm not schooled, I don't understand the news I'm reading, but at least I'm upset about it, folks. Just what do you want from me anyway? Permission to be a fake? Stop whining. Do something about it.
Hurt plays brilliantly against every expectation in this movie, and it's part of the movie's charm that everyone on screen likes him much less than we do. There are no villains up there, even though there are injustices galore. Albert Brooks, as the reporter who's too smart to be an anchorman but doesn't know it, gives a terrific performance. He tones down the whiny, needling character he so often delivers in his own films, like Lost in America, and creates a peerless portrait of that woebegone figure, the platonic best friend, too lovable to reject and too safe and unchallenging to fall for. Best of all, though, is Holly Hunter, who was last seen as Ed in Raising Arizona. Her performance here is nothing less than dazzling. In every shot, she's inventing gestures and postures and ways of delivering lines that are absolutely new. And yet none of her concoctions, many of which are wildly eccentric, seem out of character. In fact, this is the most complex and well-rounded characterization I've seen on screen all year. Brooks wants his movie to make some high-minded points about the compromised nature of TV news, about how integrity always loses out to flash, about how the importance of TV news behooves its makers to try harder. And by the end of the movie, he's behooved us to death. The last half hour or so gets strident and puritanical, and, given the sophistication of what's gone before it, strangely naive about the nature of TV. But no matter. Broadcast news is such a wonderfully entertaining sitcom that, ironically, it almost makes you believe in television again.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with cartoonist Roz Chast, whose quirky pen and ink drawings appear regularly in the New Yorker magazine. Also, John McCutcheon will perform on his Hammered Dulcimer, and film critic Stephen Scherf will review Wall Street, starring Michael Douglas and Charlie Sheen, and directed by Oliver Stone of Platoon fame. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.